Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey Fleck here along with Shad Marquitz. We are your hosts for this weekend show. As always, also your hosts throughout the week on our website, kereport.com, and podcast, Corlin Economics Report. It was another busy week because of the Fed meeting and the volatility that we are seeing really in every market, and unfortunately for the precious metals investors, what looks like another week of a little bit of disappointment. We are kicking off the show with Axel Merk, President and Chief Investment Officer at Merk Investments. Axel, since the Fed met this week, let's start there. We really didn't hear too much new out of the Fed other than, look, they are confirming that it seems like March will be the start of their rate hiking cycle. The unwind of QE would have been done by that time. And then a lot of questions around some sort of balance sheet unwinding or quantitative tightening. We don't know when that's going to happen. And quite frankly, I think the Fed just wants to see how the markets react to the start of rate hikes. Axel, what's your thought broadly this year as it comes to the Fed and what they keep telling us is going to be a rate hiking cycle starting in March?
Well, great to be with you again. And the first couple of hours answering your question, I'll focus on one aspect and then I'll go into the next one. Let me try to take a step back. Overall, the Fed was caught behind the curve. At the latest last August, they should have realized that inflation is running high. They apparently noodled around with that concept in December, which became more clear when they published their so-called minutes. And now they're going to continue to print money, but now they're quote-unquote humble and might hike rates. And so historically, when you're faced with inflation, you don't fix it with a salami tactic. You go out front, which means in this August, in December, or maybe with intraday, they should have done something, certainly not continue to print money. And what happens, some people say, oh, now they've caught up and they're all hawkish and all that. But basically, the implication is what you see. You see volatility because the Fed, as it's trying to play catch up, the markets will throw a fit. And we're going to go back and forth. And the proof is, of course, going to be in the pudding, which nobody knows what that pudding is going to look like. And so we see gyrations in the market. And that's probably what we will continue to see. Clearly, when you're faced with new information, you shouldn't start a debating club. You should act. And you reference the balance sheet. I mean, that's a prime example of a debating club. They got burned last time when they reduced the balance sheet. And so they decided to just not look at it. And the so-called principles that they now published, it's really they were scrambling to decide what to do. They decided, all right, we got to hike rates. That's what we have to do. And then they decided, well, we got to put out something. And so they put out some platitudes on what they're going to do with the balance sheet. But they haven't really thought about it. And so in the meantime, Powell, during his press conference, was repeating his talking points and scared the markets into thinking he's going to be super hawkish. And nobody really knows, including the Fed, what they'll actually be doing.
Well, Axel, as they embark on this rate hiking cycle, and it will be a series of hikes, some people are saying 3 to 4, JP Morgan with Jamie Dimon saying 8, who knows what it'll actually be. But is there going to be a point where people realize, even the generalists realize, that even if they start hiking these rates, they're not anywhere close to where the inflation rates are running? With CPI running at 7% for December, even if it ratchets down a little bit, can they really stop inflation or squash it down by doing 0.25% hikes, even if they do 4, 5, 6 of them?
Well, it depends on where you're philosophically or politically on this. First of all, as we're through Powell's press conference, there was one additional rate hike priced in. And so the market at the end of the press conference priced in 5 rate hikes for this year. That's what the market says. So whatever that may be. But overall, yes, I mean, everybody is kind of thinking, well, what can they do? It remains to be seen, right? From a perspective of what needs to be done. Again, you don't amputate a leg by starting with a toe, right? You amputate the leg, so you should go out in front of it. What the Fed is doing is saying, well, if inflation persists and we think inflation is going to be no problem, then we'll just have to keep raising rates. And to those who are critical of that, including me, saying, well, no, that is a very high-risk approach. What you do is you get out up front in the problem. You don't just rely on the reputation of the Fed to fight inflation. You actually do it by showing some action. And I know that a lot of your listeners will say, well, what reputation of the Fed? When I talk about reputation of the Fed, I look at what the market is thinking. So in the market, for example, you can with some fancy math, you can say what inflation expectations are 5 years out, 10 years out. Well, nobody has a clue what inflations are 10 years out. But what the market says is that they believe the Fed will get this under control. And you and I may have our doubts. What surprised me, if there was something that was surprising at the meeting, is that there weren't any dissents. We have the most hawkish FOMC members that are voting this year in many, many years. And so I would have thought that Esther George, a very hawkish person who is not afraid to be outspoken, would have dissented, maybe two others. Nobody did. And so the question to me really is, what did Powell promise them? And I think this dance around flexibility and being humble and with the market and saying, oh, they could actually do more, is what it got to have these hawkish Fed member back off. And so that's in the context of there is, quote unquote, confidence that the Fed will do the right thing. Now, I cannot build my investment strategy based on hopes that things will work out fine. I happen to think this is a very dangerous road that they're on. And so I happen to think that, to answer your question, inflation is a process. And once inflation is high, people will try to raise prices no matter what. I agree that supply chain issues will eventually be resolved. The fiscal stimulus is a bit less. The year-over-year comparisons are more difficult. But if I look at the sort of wages I just pay in my own firm these days, if I look at the price hikes I see everywhere, I don't see that just vanish because the Fed has some more hawkish talk.
So, Axel, I understand that the Fed is concentrating on inflation because inflation has run a lot hotter than they expected last year. What about the markets? How do those play into the Fed's outlook, too? Because we've seen the Fed backtrack on policy due to market weakness. And boy, oh boy, this month, the start of this year already has been very volatile for really every sector.
Well, as much as we all like to believe that the Fed focus on the equity markets, what they really focus on is what they call our financial conditions, which means the spreads of risk assets in the fixed income market, including junk bonds, over treasuries. And so that happens to be correlated with the S&P 500. But and of course, the more hawkish tone ever since the FOMC minutes have come out have increase those spreads, those financial conditions have quote unquote tightened, but just a tad. And by the way, that's one of the reasons why the Fed thinks they have all the time in the world, because they've already talked financial conditions a little bit tighter, which is of course cheaper in quotes than hiking rates. It's of course always a very fine line. And with all this credit we have in the economy and the leverage we have everywhere, it's of course very, very possible that there are spillover effects to the S&P 500 and other markets that then can lead to quite a severe downdraft. And if that were to happen, odds are that the availability of credit to these overleveraged businesses is drying up, and that's when the Fed would get concerned. But as long as it's quote unquote just the S&P 500 that's plunging, that's not going to sway them.
Well, actually, just another question that I don't think a lot of mainstream media addresses, and that is with the Fed finishing their tapering and pulling back what they were doing of $120 billion a month of bond purchases down to zero in just two more months now. Do you think there's going to be a point where the bond market has a reaction to this, where there's not enough people to buy the bonds when the United States put theirs up for auction? And could that be a cause of a great rotation out of bonds, you know, looking to other sectors? Could some of that money come into the general equities to help, I guess, buoy them? Could some of that come into precious metals? Will they go into cryptos? Do you think there'll be a migration out of bonds as this unfolds?
Well, sure. I mean, bonds have become far riskier, so to speak. They're always riskier, but the Federal Reserve's job is take out the perceived risk. But regarding the balance sheet, one thing to keep in mind, so the Fed will phase out its purchases in March, and then hasn't announced yet, has to get its act together, who knows when, might start reducing the balance sheet. And many people, including us, think that if, and that's a big if, and when they start to get to that, it might be as much as $80 billion, $85 billion a month in reduction. And they can do that mostly because the maturity of the portfolio they have in treasuries is very short. Now, that said, we have a European Central Bank and the Bank of Japan that keeps printing. And incidentally, that's just about in that order of magnitude. And so we're not exactly taking liquidity out of the market. We shouldn't think of the U.S. as an isolated space. As long as you have free capital flows, and by the way, that's why we don't include what the Chinese are doing. But as the big three central banks, a treasury is kind of interchangeable with a bond. Now, obviously, currency risk and so forth, and it's different governments and different types of risk, but those are in their respective countries considered to be the safe assets. And so there will be, if the Europeans are printing money and the Japanese continue to print money, it's not like we are withdrawing the liquidity left and right. And so these are all things on the margin that have an impact. Now, where will the money move? First of all, some money will just evaporate. Because when leverage is reduced, which is one of the side effects of tightening conditions, the money just is gone. It's not just it's moving from A to B. And then where it goes, well, the meme stocks haven't had much money. I've called it the funny money season is over. And so yeah, kind of that quote-unquote bubble, so to speak, maybe burst for good. And whether or not it moves to something like gold, well, the way I look at gold is that gold obviously doesn't pay you a dividend. And so I look at it whether on a real basis it is attractive to hold cash. And there I'm looking less at the short-term rates, but something like a 10-year yield. And as we're talking, we are just under minus 60 basis points on 10-year real yield. So you're paying the government, so to speak, 60 basis points, 0.6% a year for the honor of holding treasuries. And that's up from about minus 1% just a few weeks ago. But as long as those real yields continue to be a somewhat negative, there is really very little incentive to hold treasuries, and something like gold does well. The other thing that gold historically has done, and we've seen in up to today we're speaking here pretty much, but gold had been a good diversifier in much of January to buffer the drafts. And I think that role it continues to have. Now, clearly, if the Fed were to do a Volcker on us, then you will get compensated on cash and gold will be no good. If you think that the Fed is going to, quote unquote, overdo it and kill the economy, well, guess what? Then they have to cut rates again, right? And where do they go, right? And so it's really, as I said in the beginning, we'll see volatility. You kind of want to wake up your mind how this is going to play out. And then stick to that plan and cross-check it periodically, but not get jolted around every 5 minutes, and because that will probably be a sure way of losing money.
So, Axel, let's focus a little bit more on gold, because there are a lot of gold investors that are saying, look, inflation is high and keeps on rising. Real yields continue to be negative, and gold continues to correct. It's a 16-plus month correction right now in an environment where the gold investors have been told this should be the perfect environment. Now, I realize that there are some other factors at play here, and it's more about the direction in terms of where rates or real rates are going. Plus, we do have to understand that the Fed is starting a rate hiking cycle. No one knows how long that is going to take, but what do you have to say to those gold investors that are saying, look, gold should be doing better. I'm getting tired of this sector because gold has continued to underperform practically everything.
Well, let's start with the quote-unquote good news. Some folks who have been quote-unquote tired of gold have chased the meme stocks and other things. And in some ways, that's one of the factors that has reduced the volatility in the sector somewhat because we don't have the short-term speculator there quite as much. That said, yes, I mean, investing is all about surviving the frustration you have with whatever the market throws at you. And any gold investor is quite familiar with that. Gold is the type of asset that with hindsight, it was always good to hold it, and you never quite know why you hold it for tomorrow, right? And I don't think that has changed much. It's a, and if you'd ask me what the price of gold is going to be tomorrow, I don't know. Where you ask me where it's going to be in 5 years, well, I think the Fed will have been through the tightening and we may be back on the easing cycle, and late cycle gold tends to do well. Does it mean it can't get whacked around in between? Yeah, of course it can. And if you go to the gold miners, the large companies have the best balance sheet they've had in years, which is good on the one hand, but on the other hand, it reduces the leverage to the price of gold. And that's part of the reason why they hadn't read it quite as much. We believe that these big companies need to go out and acquire additional resources so that they have to replenish the gold, so to speak, that they're getting out of the ground. And so we see a lot of opportunity there, but yes, that's a very, very volatile sector, and a sector where these exploration companies, they need to access the markets once a year, once every other year. And if financial conditions are tight, that's obviously a significant risk in a rising rate environment. So this has always been a volatile space. I like it, but it doesn't mean that it's going to be smooth sailing in an environment where the Fed hasn't really made up its mind on many things. And keep in mind, as much as you may love or hate the Fed, they do have the bazooka at the end of the day.
They do have a bazooka. The question I have, Axel, is did they wait too long to use it? Because we've hit what was a pretty good growth period a year ago, and now we're getting to the point where we're seeing a lot of forecasts for GDP growth to start tapering down and slowing down. The economy itself could be slowing down. And so if you look at what we have as kind of a stagflationary environment where growth is slowing, wages are high, energy prices are high, inflation is high, and they do this possibly policy error by hiking too aggressively, could we actually trigger a recession? And if that's the case, would that environment get some safe haven flows into gold potentially?
Yeah, it sure might. And when I look at investing, it's about taking risk scenarios into account. And you use the word stagflation, right? Nothing is like the 1970s. Well, yeah, there are plenty of parallels, and they are piling up. And yes, the Fed was absolutely late, and that's why we'll see, in my view, volatility. Right. And yes, we'll see a slowdown. What the Fed did is we had supply chains clogged up and they put the pedal to the metal. In addition, we got fiscal spending. So the demand was high. Well, guess what? You get inflation if you can't produce enough. Now, presumably with Omicron wave getting lower and midterm election coming up, we might open up the economy. Sorry, I did not say that the government is going to base policy based on politics. It's purely based on the virus abating. But if you look at China, for example, I wouldn't be surprised that after the Olympics, they move on from their super tight policy, which means that you will have some of these supply bottlenecks opening up. And so we'll continue to get a very, very mixed bag of data. But to the question of whether the Fed could induce a recession, yeah, absolutely, it's possible. And whether that would be beneficial to the price of gold, presumably. I mean, it depends, right? Because if we have a Paul Volcker who decides that interest rates need to go very high, then not. I happen to think that Mr. Powell is no Paul Volcker, and the price of gold will be doing just fine in the years to come.
So, Axel, what do you think are the key catalysts this year then? Since we are still so early in the year and a lot is changing this year compared to last year, what do you think is going to be most important for investors to watch, whether they're invested in gold, U.S. markets, or simply just watching these markets?
Well, in the long run, you want to look at these longer term inflation expectations. And the reason is because they're the best gauge whether the market, not you or I, but the market has confidence in the Fed's ability to get inflation under control. And the reason I refer to the dissents is because if Powell manages to hurt the cats at the Fed, that will instill some confidence into the market that he got that. And so then we just have to think about what's going to happen in the economy overall and what those implications are. But if we're going to see some dissent saying, hey, the Fed isn't doing enough, Or if we get a governor dissent, not just the regional presidents, the governors historically rarely ever dissent, that means that that Powell is losing control over herding the cats. For now, they give him the benefit of the doubt and say, hey, yeah, you continue doing your job. So that's the one thing I'm most concerned about looking at that. Other than that, with regard to gold, I'm somebody who likes to look at real interest rates, not on a current basis, but on a forward-looking basis, the TIPS yield, the inflation-protected securities yield. That's something I watch closely. And then otherwise, what I'm looking at is whether gold continues its function as a diversifier. And I have little doubt that it does. But it doesn't mean it always has a zero correlation to the S&P 500. These things morph in and out. And so it remains to be seen. But we see money attracted to gold when it serves the core function of being a diversifier, when it is a hedge against a negative real yield. And then, of course, you got the trend followers, and they haven't been as active in the gold market, which I, if anything, see somewhat of a positive because it also reduces the amplitude on the corrections.
Well, Axel, you had mentioned that we may be in the end of funny money season. So I just want to circle back to that before we wrap up, because we have seen some pretty crazy things over the last couple of years with so many new investors opening trading accounts, record amounts of new people at home, stuck at home, that decided they're going to start becoming day traders or investors. And so we saw the rise of the meme stocks, which you referenced earlier, but we also saw NFTs, cryptos racing to the moon, biotech stocks, Tesla being worth more than all the other 14 car companies. It just seemed like there, Cathie Wood's ARK Innovations Fund and growth stocks taking off. And now there's been a shaking of the tree. Do you think we're kind of at an end of cycle period after a 12-year run from the great financial crisis to present?
Well, the beginning of the end, let's put it this way. The thing is that, as Greenspan said in '96, markets can be markets are exuberant, right? But they can be irrational longer than you can be solvent. So I'm not suggesting all the craziness that's been induced since the financial crisis is going to be over. But the slight tightening does expose some of the craze that's out there. And there's just a story out there, and I'm not giving an investment recommendation on any of these stocks, but apparently the attorney general in Massachusetts is suing Fidelity because the blokes who opened options accounts had too easy a time to open option accounts. When they got rejected, they just refilled another application that said where they said they have more experience, and then apparently it's Fidelity's fault that those guys lied. And so there will be, once you are in this phase where the party is coming to an end, you suddenly the regulator is going to come and clamp down on many of these things. And so if I just look at the asset flows, we had until a few days ago a lot of retail money out of equity markets. As we're speaking, recent days, some of that has come back in. I would not rule out that not all irrationality in the market is going to be evaporating, but this slight tightening might expose some of the worst excesses. And I specifically single out the meme stocks because I think most people would agree on that, whereas some of the other things you mentioned, reasonable minds might disagree on some details.
All right, Axel, we're wrapping it up here. It's always interesting hearing your take on the markets. I enjoy reading over all of your work, and quite frankly, I really appreciate you taking some time to share your thoughts on this year and the Fed and the whole situation that it's not just the U.S. is in right now. But boy, oh boy, this year is sure going to be interesting. Axel, thank you as always for your time. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend, and I look forward to bringing you back on the show next month.
Thank you. And follow me on Twitter at Axel Merck. Thanks, and take care.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody enjoyed those first two segments with Axel Merk. We're going to be continuing to focus on the Fed statement and even more so the market reaction as we are now chatting with Mike Larson, editor of the Safe Money Report. You can also follow Mike on Twitter at RealMikeLarson. Now, Mike, I know we're going to focus a lot on the weakness in the U.S. equity markets, especially after the, statement by the Fed this week. But overall, markets have been weak all year. And some of the high-flying stocks, some of the meme stocks, it's not out of the question to say that these stocks are crashing. Again, though, let's start with the Fed statement. Anything surprise you out of that Fed statement, and what caught your eye the most?
You have Jay Powell that really, with the data the way it's been, with the economic backdrop and sort of political pressure and conundrum that he's facing there, really has no choice but to talk tough, right? And that's what he did at this most recent Fed meeting. I mean, he's really, the Main Street is getting fed up with inflation. That's gains of inflation and prices that are outpacing wage and salary gains. You get big, good wage figures and you think it's great, but when your personal expenses go up even more than your wages, you're losing money on a real basis. So Main Street's getting pinched by inflation. The numbers have gotten so big and so bad. I mean, the Fed looked ridiculous going out there with this narrative that it's transitory and it doesn't matter. I mean, it finally got to the point where you just got to say the emperor has no clothes, and so to regain some market credibility and some policymaking credibility, the Fed had to step up and kind of acknowledge what's going on. And Powell talked pretty tough. I mean, at this meeting, he had the opportunity to sort of shoot down the building bearish sentiment that we saw in January. And we can talk about the markets in a minute, but it's clear that the markets were scared of the bad inflation data and were scared of the Fed, but thought maybe they might throw him a bone. But that's not what happened. Powell basically refused to rule out things like 50 basis point hikes, which the Fed hasn't done in ages. I mean, it's always moved in the last couple of decades in these sort of telegraphed 25 basis point hikes that they lay the groundwork for ahead of time. He also didn't really, push against the idea that the balance sheet is enormous and that the balance sheet could be scaled back pretty aggressively. So not just shrinking the balance sheet, the Fed's balance sheet, by letting old bonds roll off and not replacing them with new bonds, but actually selling down its portfolio of treasuries and mortgage-backed securities. So, the game and the messaging was, we're going to hike pretty soon, probably starting at the March meeting. We can't promise you it won't be aggressive hikes, meaning more frequent than in the past and potentially larger than in the past. And on top of that, we might pull back the support in terms of, asset buying and actually start shrinking the balance sheet much faster than we did in the last economic cycle. So that is sort of a double or triple whammy, depending on how you want to count it. And the markets have reacted. I mean, the fears that the equity markets were reflecting in the first couple of weeks of January were validated by the Fed. And then on top of that, really the bond market reaction to me is what's even more interesting, because in the wake of the Powell comments, initially all yields started moving higher as he started talking tough and the statement came out and everything. But then what ended up happening by the end of the day is that short-term yields, those most closely affected by the Fed or most closely controlled by the Fed, things like the two-year note yield and everything shorter term than that, held the lion's share of their gains. But long-term yields, yields on 10-year and especially 30-year treasury bonds did not. The 30-year treasury bond began giving back its gains pretty sharply. And then in the next day, bond yields actually collapsed at the long end of the curve. So what you're seeing, because short end yields are higher or holding up most of their post-Fed gains, but long-term yields, particularly on 30s, are not, you're ending up with a situation where the yield curve is flattening dramatically. And that's, the yield curve is a good harbinger when it inverts of recession. We're nowhere near inversion yet, but we are at a point where, all the way back to last March, April, that's when the curve stopped steepening. The bond market at the long end has never really believed this is a great new world where the, growth is going to be great, where, we don't have this debt overhang, we don't have an aging population, we don't have structural issues, it's going to be wonderful, we're going to get back to the yields of yesteryear, as I call them. The bond market at the long end hasn't really believed that for a long time, and the Fed is only making that worse now. You sum it all up and you look at bond market, stock market, weak parts of the stock market that we can talk about, the sort of really junky tech stocks. It all is pointing to, at the very least, sort of a yellow flag, yellow light environment. This isn't necessarily a, we're right on the cusp of a huge bear market. yet. Who knows if that'll end up happening, but we are getting a lot of warning signs in a lot of different places that this isn't the same kind of, fear-free excess liquidity, buy almost anything and make money kind of market that we had for quite a long time.
Well, Mike, it is interesting how much turbulence there's already been before the rate hike cycle even gets started. And the Fed, at their own admission, has said that when they put these policies in place and when they take these actions, so when they start hiking these rates, and if they do reduce the balance sheet, the effects of those take 6 to 9 months to even show up. So while you mentioned it's a yellow light and not a red light yet for a recession, if the yield curve is flattening, if energy rates have doubled, that's another harbinger of a recession. If there's this rate hiking cycle that's going to start into slowing growth, could we be setting up for a much more turbulent year than people expect? And would that cause the Fed to backpedal if it gets too turbulent?
Yeah, I guess we'll start with the part where we talk about some of these stocks that, that behind the scenes have really been falling apart. I mean, your listeners and you guys know the names, the ARK technology, ARK Innovation kind of names, Cathie Wood, these money losing, very speculative, someday we're going to make a profit at inventing a new business, whether it's, spaceflight tourism or EVs or all this other stuff. That whole contingent of the stock market, it's basically like, if you go back to the late 1990s, it's basically like the CMGIs and the DrCoop.com and InfoSpace and all those, junk NASDAQ.com companies that came out back then that didn't make any money, but they told a new and exciting story. Valuations for a while didn't matter, and that's all anybody wanted to own. And, those stocks went up 300, 400, 500, 600%. But then when they started falling, there was no valuation floor. There was no support. Once you pulled the rug out from under them, they kept falling, month in and month out to the point where, half of these names, all these popular IPOs went bankrupt, and the ones that didn't were down 80, 90%. Because I like the ARK ETF. I mean, it topped out at the beginning of 2021. It peaked all the way back in February of last year. That was around $160. Now it's going for $67. You look at something like a Robinhood. I mean, this is, the brokerage app that everybody was trading on. All the people buying and selling meme stocks and trading options they didn't really understand. A couple of days after that stock IPO, it hit $85. This week, it traded under $10 a share after lousy earnings. So, these aren't small declines. And you can go right down the list. You can talk about AMC, the movie theater, ultimate meme stock. It topped $70, back in June. It was just trading at $14.50 this week. These are breathtaking declines. These are, at the periphery, the junkiest of the junk stocks, the riskiest of the money losing companies that people were all so excited about and dogpiling into. Those ones are getting massacred. I mean, it is truly a crash in that part of the market. Now, it hasn't and hadn't mattered to the broader averages much for a while. I mean, you didn't see the broader averages suffering, and some of the mega cap tech companies even were holding up very well. If you look at the QQQs, if you look at, the Amazons of the world and Netflix and so on, they didn't have any problems, even as some of the stuff was going on at the periphery. But, you're seeing it migrate back to that core. I mean, everybody loved the FANG names. Netflix is the N in FANG. It was trading for $700 not too long ago. After lousy earnings, it was all the way down to about, just over $350. So basically got cut in half in a couple of months. Amazon, everybody owns it. It's in portfolios all over. It's trading right around now at the same price it traded in June of 2020. So you literally haven't made a penny a share in the most popular retail / cloud computing company since June of 2020. So again, you can go down the list. That kind of stuff's going on. With the Fed that's getting less friendly, with a Fed that's kind of backed into a corner by this political pressure, this lousy inflation data, it's not the same supportive regime where the Fed was guaranteed to be Wall Street's friend and would do almost anything it could to support the stock market. It really can't pull that off anymore, given what's going on. So really, it's again, I don't want to say that we're on the cusp of some huge dot-com style crash. But we are, if you go back to what happened then, the NASDAQ didn't top out until March of 2000. It didn't start losing ground till then. But a lot of the peripheral stocks all the way back in spring of 99 started falling apart. I mean, you had a lot of losses, again, just like this year and this last 12 months, where the riskiest stuff, the riskiest dot-coms back then started falling, 9-10 months ahead of the NASDAQ. You're seeing kind of the same thing happen now. So it's definitely a yellow light, yellow flag, whatever you want to call it, and certainly a time to consider being more cautious, being in safe money style stocks, focusing on yield, focusing on companies with higher Weiss ratings, focusing on the stuff that may not be, you know, sound sexy, but you know what is sexy to me? Not losing 60% in 3 months.
That's a good point there, but not to oversimplify this or downplay it, but isn't this kind of expected if the Fed is taking away the punch bowl and slowly starting to increase rates, no matter how many they get done in this time frame, then it is natural to see money flow out of some of these riskier stocks and more into some of the fundamental stocks, or quite frankly, just out of the market, because the Fed has had such a supportive hand in continuing to inject capital into the system, which then lands in the market. So shouldn't this all be kind of expected as long as the Fed stays down this course?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a question of degree, right? I mean, whenever the Fed starts to turn off that spigot, you know, you get different degrees of impact in the market. I mean, back in 2018, the Fed tried to step back from it and you know, they had the whole Powell pivot. You know, the market was able to sort of find its footing again and rally from there on. And we didn't make a market peak in that cycle until the COVID epidemic struck. If you go back to, you know, the infamous soft landing in 94, 95, same thing. The Fed hiked, you had parts of the market that got slammed, the bond market threw a tantrum. But ultimately, after the stock market fell on its footing, it rallied in the back half of the 1990s. Then, if you want to look for a potentially scary analog, you can look at what happened in the dot-com cycle. I mean, the Fed started hiking. They hiked, obviously, that was when rates overall were a lot higher. They got, you know, they hiked for months on end. They got all the way up to where they were in 2000. And that was, you know, part of the reason that the dot-com market, the dot-com bubble began to pop. You know, here, it's funny, they haven't even technically raised rates yet. They're only talking about doing it in a few months. But you're already starting to see this impact at the periphery. Like I said, the yield curve has already been flattening for almost a year now, 10 months. So it's potentially a situation where if the Fed follows through with an aggressive policy stance into a market where the yield curve is flattening dramatically and, you know, the peripheral stocks are signaling some liquidity issues, it's not a really good policy mix, and it's not a great environment for an investor. So certainly you want to be cautious. You want to have your antenna up. Again, I don't think this is a turn around and sell everything at the open tomorrow kind of market or next week or whatever. But I do think that, you know, you've got to look through your portfolio. I mean, I've been begging people to sell all that junk, you know, dozens of percentage points ago. I mean, I hated those stocks last year. I was not shy about saying, if you're in that junk, you're going to get killed. So I hope that our investors largely have avoided that. The question now is, does that sort of pain migrate up the quality scale and come, you know, hit the bigger stocks, the companies that do have much better fundamentals? And I don't think we're quite at that point yet, but certainly, you know, January was basically one of the worst. I think I looked at some numbers and it was basically in the top 10 worst NASDAQ months since there's been a NASDAQ, essentially. It compared with, I guess, the, you know, of the top 20 declines in the NASDAQ, this was probably like 7 or 8 or something. And the other times that were in the top 20 all happened in the great financial crisis and the dot-com bust. Those were obviously painful bear market periods, and that's not a very good, you know, good place you want to be. So certainly, you know, something to keep your eye on, watch what's happening, make sure you're not in those sort of junky parts of the market, and just be more defensive, you know, focus on higher quality companies, companies that actually make money, companies that have some dividend protection, companies that again, a lot of these people, I fear, especially some of the younger investors, you know, wouldn't know Procter & Gamble's ticker symbol if you asked them, because all they know is the hot tech stocks. And that's if you have your portfolio is over, you know, over focused or over weighted in those kinds of stocks, and you don't own the Procter & Gamble's or Clorox's or other, you know, defensive kind of names that give you more stability and more protection, you're in real trouble here. So that's the best advice that I can have, is just look at what happened in the dot-com scenario. You know, let's not go there automatically and say that we're destined to have that something that bad happen again. But let's look at some of the parallels and realize, hey, you know, if you ignore this stuff, you're doing yourself a disservice. I mean, there are some similarities, and in some cases, some really scary, very close similarities. So just something to keep in mind.
Yeah, Mike, we heard a lot about the January effect, and everybody was so excited coming out of the Santa Claus rally. But it's really started off to be a turbulent year. And what I wonder is if there's going to be a sea change as far as all these new investors that came into the marketplace over the last 2 years, they were, you know, people were stuck at home. They opened up their trading accounts. There was a lot of new trading platforms that even started in the last 2 years. And to your point, most of them are not diversified into consumer staples or into utilities or into dividend paying stocks. They went after the high beta. And you just made the point a second ago that it may start moving up the food chain. I mean, today, as we're talking, Tesla was down 12%. If you look at stocks that at least had some business plan around them, the stay-at-home stocks, you know, Zoom is down about 70-some percent in the last 6 months. Peloton is down about 80%. It was at $120, and now it's at $24. And so these are big moves. Is it possible that people won't be rotating from one sector to the next, but they actually just got wiped out? And the breadth indicator shows that there's so many stocks that are making new 52-week lows. Could this change the way this new generation of investors looks at investing, and maybe they'll get more responsible and get into those safe money type of names that you cover in your service?
Yeah, I really do hope. I mean, I wish that people would sometimes learn lessons the easy way, but unfortunately, I mean, you see the market teach different generations and different investors the same kinds of lessons over and over again. You know, those losses, while painful, they do tend to be educational and instructive, and hopefully make it so that you as an investor, or you as a trader, next time you get in a similar situation or are faced with similar risks, you know how to behave more smartly and adapt your portfolio better. But yeah, I mean, these declines are not small. They're not, you know, gentle corrections. These are actual crashes in some of these names. And again, I kind of cut my teeth. I came out of college in the late 1990s. I cut my teeth investing in the dot-com bubble. I worked for a dot-com, you know, our stock fell apart at the company I worked for and so on. So, you know, I learned a lot of lessons right at the sort of when I was a youthful investor. And I see a lot of similarities and parallels to what's happening now. So all I can do is try and speak from, you know, the experience that I had. And I certainly don't know everything. I learn something new in the markets every day, but I do feel like I've had similar experiences in a different round of stocks and seeing some similar patterns. So what I'm trying to do is communicate to people who may not have seen this kind of stuff before and say, hey, look, you know, sometimes you buy a stock and it doesn't just get cheaper. It just never comes back. You know, people say, oh, hold stocks for the long term. And that's true for good stocks. But you know what? There's plenty of stocks that just disappeared, that went broke, that took 95% of your money and then never gave anything back. And you have to understand that some of these no business plan, no earnings, you know, winging a prayer, you know, maybe someday we'll make a profit on some kind of EV 20 years from now, you know, that's all great and wonderful. But I mean, what was that company that pushed a truck down a hill just to try and prove that it had an actual product? I mean, you know, there's a lot of shenanigans and garbage going on that very much reminds me of that late 90s period. And the lesson back then is, you know, if you don't diversify, if you don't own some quality, if you don't learn about parts of the market that aren't swept up in the mania, and you have all your money and all your capital in that sort of manic sector, when things turn against you, when the tide turns, it's painful. And sometimes it just doesn't come back. So I think that that's an important lesson that people should probably keep in mind. They really should be educating themselves about other stocks, other sectors, other assets that can preserve their wealth and maybe grow it even in a tougher market where, you know, the sort of rising tide of liquidity isn't sweeping everything higher.
That's the key point, right? This rising tide of liquidity has been at least a little bit taken away, and the process is in place now for it to get taken away. So we'll just see how much more of an impact it has. But just to summarize a couple other stats that we have for these markets, the S&P is off to the worst start in the first 16 days of trading ever. I saw that on Bloomberg. I think you mentioned the ARK fund down 53%. Tesla's down over 30% just this month. There's a lot of breakdowns happening within these markets, and we just haven't seen this environment in quite a while. So it's a whole new world and a whole new year. Let's see how the rest of this year goes. But boy, oh boy, tail end of January sure is tough on a wide range of sectors. Mike, great chatting with you. Thanks again for your time, buddy. We'll chat again in another couple weeks. Have a great rest of your weekend.
You got it. Take care.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. For
providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back here to wrap up the weekend edition of the KE Report. We are going to continue our focus on the U.S. equity markets broadly as we are now chatting with T.G. Watkins, Director of Stocks over at Simpler Trading, also editor at the Profit Pilot website. Before we get into some of the market commentary, TG is also hosting a free webinar on Monday after the market close, more of a market update to bring everybody up to speed on how he's trading these markets. And quite frankly, the markets have been very volatile and fairly weak, especially when you dive down into individual stocks. That now is an important time, I think, to be active with your portfolio. TG, before we get into some of the market commentary, give us a little background on this market update, why you're doing it now, and what you're hoping to pass along in terms of information to everybody that tunes in.
Yeah, basically, so what we're going to be talking about, kind of the macro of what's going on here. We know that the Fed is taking the punch bowl away from the party. They're going to be raising rates. They're going to be quantitative tightening. They're going to be basically trying to remove themselves a little bit to so they can free up their toolbox for the next emergency that they need to use things for. And the market's having to reevaluate all this stuff and reprice it. And then we've also seen that, you know, the names that really went crazy in 2022 were extremely high PE names and names that really didn't have any revenue. So right now the play is, if you do need to find any safety, it's basically in, you know, really old school consumer staples and oil. Markets really need to figure out where they can go because by law, investing companies need to be 80-90% invested at all times. So they got to put money someplace. There's got to be a place to hide out. It may not be perfect. They might still lose money, but at least it's a way to say, hey, we only lost 5% as opposed to 45%. So there are opportunities. But if you can also then short, we are seeing a lot of opportunities here because a lot of these growth stocks are just deflating. I mean, it's crazy to see the number of names that are basically deflating back to where they began before 2020, you know, before the Fed started the thing, before COVID happened. So at least for me, it's kind of been like shooting fish in a barrel on the short side, which is fantastic. And I think we're only just now seeing the beginning of it. Now, I don't think this is going to last forever, of course, but I do think that this is going to be fairly fast. It's going to last a few months, you know, something like that. And it's going to be aggressive. And so if you guys can be trading to the short side, there are opportunities. You know, maybe if you're even looking at inverse ETFs, if you need to trade the indexes the other direction and say your Roth IRA that you can only go long in, you know, there are opportunities to take advantage of this market since clearly the trend is to the downside right now.
Well, everybody, definitely check out the Profit Pilot website, which we'll include a link to in this, and check out that event with TG because he is a great coach as to getting you through the markets and how he's trading the markets, what he's seeing. So TG, you mentioned there some of the weakness and some of the shorting opportunities. You know, what kind of technical indicators are you looking for in some of these, I guess, growth stocks that are continuing to sell down? What are you looking for in the charts that gives you the impetus to say, hey, this thing's going lower?
Well, fortunately, the trend is pretty impressive. The trend on the downside right now is just about as good as the trend was on the upside in 2020. That's how good, at least to the downside, the trading environment is right now. I mean, we're seeing names that are following moving averages very, very cleanly. They are going basically straight down at something like a 45 or 60 degree angle, and they're doing it with speed. And any of the bounces are up into resistance and give you really clean places to short. I mean, this is a terrific shorting market as we were having a terrific long market in 2020. It's just turn it upside down at this point. You know, and I'm seeing that there are a lot of names, as I said, are going back to where they came from. Something like Plug or Blink, you know, they had an area of consolidation. And then once they broke that major area of consolidation, there is very little price congestion or price areas, price level, anything like that to really hold price and act as circuit breakers or act as tree branches on the way back down. Because these names, and you could look at the IWM, the same thing, they went up so fast. There are no areas of sideways movement. There's no flagging along the way. I mean, 2020 was straight up. And so, well, think about it on the other way down. When you start going down, where are the levels of buyers? Where are the levels of tree branches or circuit breakers? As I say, price consolidation, previous price consolidation, where, you know, it's going to be a little thick for price to get through. It's like That's not happening because it went straight up and then it's going straight down because there's no level of support. And so if you can kind of find these right names and take a look at them, just start searching around the market and you'll see what I'm talking about. These names are just going straight back down to where they began.
So TG, is there a certain sector that you find that you're finding more shorting opportunities, or are you seeing these opportunities across the board?
A lot of it is across the board, which makes it a little bit concerning about how pervasive this is throughout the market. I mean, it's not just really a sector. I mean, we're really seeing a lot of stuff get hit. Yeah, just a lot of stuff is getting hit in general. But take a look at anything that did really well in 2020, and it's probably going to get unwound right now, and it has been for the last few months. And specifically anything that just has either high PE or is tech-based or has a lot of debt because they have to service that debt, and now interest rates are going up, so that's they're going to have to reevaluate that as far as their, you know, the price of their stock and their valuations. And then companies that really aren't turning a profit yet, you know, companies that are still just ideas or moonshots, or like, yeah, we'll be profitable someday. And now that interest rates are going up and the free money or easy money is getting turned around and turned off, like it's all kind of coming right back down. So really, the things that you can think of as high risk, they're the ones getting targeted. And that's why, you know, right now, the play, at least for the long side, if you're willing to take it, is going to be in defensive type names. Think about names that have been around for 100 plus years or so, that have seen the ups and downs of this market, have gone through bull and bear markets, have gone through interest rates. I mean, you name it, they're still here, they're still surviving. And that's where money's going, because they're like, hey, we just need to hide out for a while and figure out a place that this company is not going to implode while these things change.
That's a great point, TG. A lot of the consumer staples, you know, your household names and products you'd know, like a Coke or a Pepsi or a Ford, those are companies that have still held up well and people go to kind of as a defensive strategy, or even some of the dividend-paying boring stocks that maybe didn't seem as exciting in years past actually seem pretty great now because you're not getting creamed. But one question a lot of people probably have, TG, is on some of these companies that have just been shellacked, some of the tech and growth stocks, even some of the stay-at-home stocks, a lot of people are wondering, should they get in for a bounce? Do you think it's a good time to get in? You had an interesting answer when I asked you that off mic. I'd love you to share that with our audience.
Well, basically, I don't think that they're going to bounce. And if they do, it's most likely going to be a bounce into a shortable area. And so I would not, if you're trying to look long, I would not be looking for a bounce. And I think that with a lot of these things, if they don't bounce, they're just going to go sideways. They're going to bear flag. They're going to go sideways until they go down further. I mean, a great example of this is DraftKings. There were at least three different levels, small, medium, and large, over the last, gosh, when does this thing start? You know, since October, September, October, that it just bear flagged. You know, you're trying to look for support. Looks like it's going to bounce. It's kind of bouncing. It's chopping. But if you look at the overall picture, it was just kind of going sideways, slowly bleeding down until it chewed through its support and then fell further. And that's actually what I'm talking about. If you look at DraftKings around October, November, you can see that it was kind of going sideways. But if you look left, there's a whole lot of price consolidation. There's a lot of action there. That's what I'm talking about that isn't happening in a lot of other stocks. You can see that is why price took so long to go lower, because there was a lot of price activity if you look left. A lot of these stocks like Blink, Plug, they went straight up. Look at the IWM itself. They went straight up. And so now that they're starting to break lower, there is no area of consolidation if you look left, which means these things are just going to be free falling until they do hit areas of support. And so, you know, if people are looking for a bounce, I would not be playing the bounce. I don't think that is a safe thing to do. A lot of these stocks, you're looking at them, it's just, they're toxic.
That's fascinating, TG. After such a strong run that a lot of stocks have had, but we did start to see some weakness last year though, right? Breadth was dropping off the table and some of the underlying stocks, maybe not the high flying ones, were correcting and down for most of the year. Is this in your eyes a natural progression then, when you do have just a year that goes so high or so easily up, and then at the end of the year you start to get some weakness, and then quite frankly you have the Fed, which is the big key here, taking away a lot of the QE programs, we are in, it sounds like, and it's what you're playing for, a more prolonged downtrend? Do you have a general time frame on this?
Yeah, well, and that's everything I'm going to be talking about on Monday. I actually have a lot of slides that I'm building right now, so I'm going to give a lot more visual as opposed to what we're just doing here talking. But I do think that we're going to be in for more. I don't really know a timeline. I've just kind of done some historical stuff, and at least for the S&P, when this tends to happen, it's about 3 months. It's just a guess. You know, it could be faster, slower, especially now that we're mostly algo trading in the markets. But I would expect probably 20%, you know, some decline like that could overshoot it. We don't know. And then, yeah, a lot of this is just the Fed's interaction. I mean, it was basically a perfect storm 2020 of having a massive drop down of something like 30% for the markets, and then coming in with huge stimulus, and then everybody being home with stimulus checks and figuring out, you know, now, again, perfect storm. Everyone can trade from home, and we have lots of education, and we have fast internet, and we have trading programs, and we have really good trading software, and people are at home. And, you know, this is something we'd never seen before. And so I think all of that combined is what shot 2020 up through the roof. And now at some point, it's just coming undone. It's just unwinding. Things have to kind of go back to wherever they came. There are going to be a lot of companies that are never going to see the light of day again. There are going to be companies that are just, their stocks are never going to recover. You know, I'd look at this stuff and say, hey, be careful if you're on the long side, because some of these things are just going to keep deflating back to where they came from. They're just going to deflate. And 2020 was probably like once in a blue moon type thing. And there will be plenty of companies that survive, but make sure you're picking the right ones. And I don't think now is the time to go pick those. I think we need to wait for the market to do its thing and see who's surviving after the dust settles.
It's a very interesting point, TG, just because there were so many new entrants into the investing arena when everybody got locked in at home and they're staying at home. And there was record amounts of new trading platforms, subscriptions opened up. So these people are now experiencing their first market correction of any significance other than maybe, you know, people that were in before the pandemic shock. Do you think that we'll see a rotation over into some more of the safe havens? You know, we've seen the dollar going up. We've seen bonds getting a bid. I'd be curious to get your thoughts on gold, whether you think it could get a precious metals safe haven bid, or what your outlook is on the precious metals sector.
Yeah, you know, actually, I exited gold yesterday. I was in a couple different positions, and it was a loss. So, you know, things looked really good. It was kind of teasing around. But basically, when the Fed came out and said, yep, we're going to raise interest rates, I think two things happened. One, the dollar shot up. And so dollar up, commodities or precious metals down. So that put pressure on it. And then two, if investors know that interest rates are going to be going up, and then they can actually put their money in fixed products that are starting to earn better interest, well, then they don't need to take the risk on precious metals, which is usually the defensive thing, or where they're like, okay, you know, I need to go into gold in order to make any kind of growth because I can't make safe growth anywhere else. So I think those two things have kind of shot gold. And, you know, I was looking at GFI, which was one of the best looking gold stocks, and it got hit hard with volume. I mean, it looked like it was doing just fine, and then it reversed the other way. So I'm completely out of gold. It didn't work. We were in it I was in GDX for a few weeks. It kept bumping around the bottom for a little bit, and now it's just rolled over and failed. So we took our stop loss on that and totally moving on from gold or any precious metals.
TG, final question here. If so much of the sell-off is due to the Fed taking away the punch bowl, how much downside do you think the Fed will withstand before they switch course? And do you think when the Fed switches course, or if they switch course, it will be enough to immediately get a buy into the markets?
You know, that's pretty funny. It reminds me a lot of 2018, right? Because anybody who was trading this during 2018, the Fed was like, yeah, okay, we're going to start normalizing. We're going to reduce the balance sheet. We're going to raise interest rates. And the market was like, uh-uh. And so it started rolling over. And this, honestly, the S&P's move right now looks like the beginning of 2018. You know, I don't know if it's going to be exact, but it might rhyme. And that's kind of how it feels. So I think back in 2018, the Fed already had raised rates a fair amount. And right now, they haven't raised them at all. They're only going to. So I think that they are really painting themselves into a corner. And I think that the market is probably going to have to just suck it up and deal at some point, because they haven't even raised rates. And if this lasts the next two, three, four months, they won't even have gotten the first rate in, or will have just gotten one in. And so they can't reverse course on that. I literally don't know what they can do And so I really have a hard time predicting that, but the market's just recalibrating right now, at least for now. And we'll have to see if this goes back up. I would imagine it will, because usually after a pretty sharp correction, the market does like to rally. And we're in a midterm elections year, which is also historically weak. So, but as far as raising interest rates and how the Fed is going to coo-coo nicely at the market, I don't know what they're going to do.
I think that's the most honest comment. Everybody is guessing what the Fed is going to do, and no one knows for sure what they are going to do. But boy, oh boy, we can sure look at the markets and get an understanding or feeling for where investors are starting to position themselves. And we are starting, finally, to see some money rotate out of these markets. We don't know how low it's going to go, but I find it very interesting that you are playing the short side, and it sounds like not just on a short-term basis either. Again, TG is hosting that free webinar on Monday. Visit his website, The Profit Pilot. We will link that in the weekend show posting. And TG, really appreciate your time. Everybody, thank you for tuning in to this weekend show. Again, go back through our website, listen to the market commentary and company updates we recorded throughout the week. I hope you all have a great rest of your weekend.